Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Okay, guys, got a good one for you this week. It's Paula Ferris. She was, until she abandoned me recently, my longtime co-host on the weekend editions of Good Morning America. If you read my most recent book, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, she was featured in there as quite a prominent character. She is somebody who's played a really important role in my life, not only as a friend and a colleague, but somebody who's really forced me to really wrestle with some of my biases. She, as you'll hear, she is not the normal character who inhabits the world of mainstream media. She comes from a very different background. She is a devout evangelical. She comes from the Midwest and went to a school that was really focused on faith. And I working with her so closely over the years has really been incredibly helpful to for me. And you'll hear us explore that. She's also done a really brave thing where she stepped back recently from Weekend GMA and her role as the co-host on The View to spend more time with their family. Often when people often when you see people stepping down from big jobs, they say they're doing it to spend time with their family. That means they got fired. That is not the case with Paula. She did not get fired. She surprised everybody by saying she really wanted to focus more on her relationship with her husband, which she felt was suffering, as well as her relationship with her relationships with her three kids as a consequence of having this incredibly unusual and hectic schedule. So now she's a senior national correspondent here at ABC News, which has been a tough transition for her. And she feels like she lost part of her identity from after stepping back from these jobs, which she wasn't quite prepared for. So she wrestles with all of this. And also, we talk a lot about her relationship with meditation, which has been interesting and helpful, and also complicated by her faith. And she has a lot to say to people of faith who are interested in but reluctant about meditation. So much more to say about Paula Ferris, much more from her coming up. But first, an item of business and then your voicemails. The item of business is, I hope you'll forgive me for being slightly salesy here, but I'm going to do it really quickly. If you want to give the gift of sanity in this holiday season as we're roaring up to Christmas here, check out the 10% Happier app. You can send it as a gift. Go to gift.10percenthappier.com and you can send somebody. This is like a great stocking stuffer or last minute gift. And I know I talked about Christmas, but and Hanukkah's over, but you know, it could be a late Hanukkah gift. All right, that's the business. Let's get your voicemails. Here's number one.
Hi, Dan. My question is about meta meditation. I did my first meta meditation a few months ago in a meditation class, and I found it to be very powerful and emotional and impactful. It brought me to tears, and I really value that experience. But when I tried to incorporate the meta meditation that I got from the teacher as he recorded meditation later, I haven't found it to be nearly as powerful. I find it almost kind of boring. And I'm wondering how you find it to still be useful and impactful more than, just as much as, or at least to some degree, as you did the first time. So thanks a lot.
Thank you. So just for newbies, we've talked about meta meditation many times on this podcast, but if you're new to the podcast, first of all, welcome. Second of all, here's a quick definition. Metta, M-E-T-T-A, is a kind of meditation that's often translated as loving kindness meditation. I'm not a huge fan for what should be obvious reasons, given my incurable skepticism and sort of anti-sentimental nature of the term loving kindness, but friendliness is a good term. So let's just call it friendliness meditation. The way it's done is you systematically envision people, visualize them, and then you repeat silently these phrases like, may you be happy, may you be healthy, et cetera, et cetera. And you usually start with an easy person, then you go to yourself, then you – the order can change, but often it's taught as starting with an easy person, then yourself, then a benefactor, a neutral person, a difficult person, and then everybody. And I have, you know, I have said many, many times that I found this practice very annoying at first, but also very powerful. And there's a lot of science to suggest it's really good for you. To your question, you said you had a very powerful experience with it the first time, but then now that you've gone back and done it subsequently, it's not as powerful and maybe a little boring. So my answer to that is, I get it. I get it. It can be frustrating when we have a powerful experience in meditation and then we feel like we're failing because we don't, quote unquote, get there the next time or ever. But that is kind of to miss the point. I don't think the point of meditation is to feel a certain way. In fact, if you go into any meditation expecting to feel a certain way, expectation is can be a deal killer. It's a classic, to put it in Buddhist terms, a classic hindrance to meditation. It's desire. You're wanting something, and that just gets in the way of it. It shuts down the whole system. So I wouldn't worry so much about achieving a certain outcome. It's about the training. It really doesn't matter in some ways what you're experiencing on the cushion. Of course, it does matter in some ways, but in some ways it doesn't. This is... no matter how dry it may feel, the act of picking up the phrases, picking up the practice, and just going back to work of envisioning these people, visualizing the beings to whom you're sending these well wishes, and going through the inner bicep curls of working your compassion muscle, that is what matters. And what the science shows is that over time, this has physiological and psychological and behavioral impacts. And the point is to keep at it, not to get hung up on having a specific experience. And the way to really measure whether it's having an impact is to do it for a while and step back and take a look at your life, not take a look at how it feels every time you're on the cushion. That is, again, not to say that the meditation experience doesn't matter at all. There may be tweaks that are needed in your practice, but really the big measure is, what is it doing to your life? All right, question number two.
Hi, Dan. Rebecca from San Francisco. And I love your podcast and your 10% Happier app. I'm a very happy subscriber. One thing that I've really learned through the app and through the courses is the principle of impermanence and equanimity. That's the term. I know that when my friends first started meditating and they would tell me about these all-day retreats or weekend retreats where they were sitting for hours on end, and if they got a muscle cramp or an itch or any discomfort, they were supposed to notice it and then let it go. And I didn't quite ever get that. To me, your body's trying to tell you something and you need to fix it. So that's where my question kind of stems from. So with the course, I do understand the learning lesson in equanimity and impermanence and just noticing things and not judging and not doing anything about it. But do you think there's also a lesson in the fact that maybe if I make a shift, a little shift, I can ease some of that discomfort? Would love to get your opinion on that. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yeah, it's a great question and not uncommon question. I think there's a line here that you got to keep your eye on. I definitely agree that sometimes your body is trying to tell you something, and if you're sitting in a certain way and you persist through the pain, you might get hurt. So if you're really in an incredible amount of pain and you think you're going to hurt your knee or sprain your ankle or whatever it is from the position you're sitting in, then yes, obviously move. The point here is not to hurt yourself. However, in my experience, a lot of the pains are not your body trying to tell you, hey, it's not similar to putting your hand on a hot stove where the pain is trying to tell you something you know, incredibly urgent. It's more that, you know, you're this is the fact of life of having a body, that after a while, if you stay in the same position, it's going to start getting uncomfortable. Maybe it's a psychological reaction as a, sort of your body, experiencing psychosomatic pain of, not wanting to face some difficult thing that's actually coming up psychologically. There are any number of reasons why you could be feeling pain, but it's not going to be life-threatening or damaging to your body. And that's where I actually do think you should sit with it, because this is when you can really make – it sucks, but you can make real strides in your practice to turn your attention from your breath in these moments to the discomfort. Watch the kind of thinking that happens as a consequence of this. Watch, see that the pain itself is not monolithic, that it does shift and move and change and vibrate. And so you can learn something about the nature of change in these moments. And you can also learn something about the fact that, as many meditation teachers will tell you, pain is inevitable. Pain is inevitable. We are, if you have a body, you will experience pain in your life. Suffering is optional. That's the stuff we add on top. And you can really see how this process works, that the pain is there, but the suffering is in our, why is this happening to me? When's this going to end? All of that stuff. And sort of disambiguating the two is something that can, is important work that can really happen in those moments of physical discomfort. Something Joseph Goldstein talks about a lot, the eminent teacher Joseph Goldstein talks, he talks, this is going to sound a little morbid, but it's not, or maybe it is, but it, not in the pejorative, that we're all going to die. And in that process, it's possible you will experience some physical discomfort. And how do you want to be in that time? And I think, you know, and I agree with Joseph's argument that you can look at pain and discomfort on the cushion as in some way practice for those moments. And yeah, I find that a really compelling thing. But definitely, if you think that you're going to hurt yourself, shift. Why not? Also, there are times, and I think I talked about this in a recent podcast, there are times when the discomfort or restlessness or pain just gets to a point where you feel like you've explored it long enough and you've reached your edge. Also, in those cases, fine, get up, shift. I do that. But you really do want to push your edge and explore it and then continue pushing and exploring it the way we would in working out, for example. You don't want to hurt yourself. You don't want to drive yourself crazy. But this is an interesting area of exploration and really valuable for the practice. And again, I will acknowledge that it also sucks in some ways. All right, let's get to Paula Ferris. She is, as I said before, an ABC News colleague of mine and a friend of mine. She was until recently the co-anchor of Good Morning America's Weekend Edition and also a co-host on The View, which is a show we do at ABC. She has got a new podcast called Journeys of Faith, which I highly recommend you listen to, in which she speaks to incredibly interesting people, many of them very well known, about the role that faith plays in their life. And Paula's insight here was that we at ABC News, we interview celebrities all the time, but it's usually they're promoting their most recent movie or asking about their whatever breakup they've gone through or, you know, what was it like to work with so-and-so in this most recent movie. But rarely do we get a chance to talk to them about the most fundamental issues in their lives. So Paula is talking to writers and actors and musicians about their faith and what role that plays in what they do. And she's doing a great job at this. She's a really probing and interesting interviewer. I will also say, as it pertains to what you'll hear, what you're about to hear, that I think a part of of my personality that I'm not sure I ever really expose on this podcast or in any of my books or anywhere, really. Maybe I do, but anyway, a part of my personality that is you're going to hear in this interview is that if I like somebody, like my wife, my kid, by the people I work with, that often results in verbal abuse. That's kind of my, as you'll hear me say with Paula, my love language. When I'm really comfortable with somebody, I make fun of them. That's just the way it is. That was the way I was raised and the way I am in the world, for better or sometimes and also for worse. Anyway, Paula and I are really close and I really like her. And so you're going to hear me tease her a little bit, and I hope that's okay. But it's a real sign of respect and affection, because that's just the mode I go into when I really like somebody. So here we go. Here's Paula Ferris. Hi, Paula Ferris.
Hi, Dan Harris. Can we wear our headphones?
No, I don't like wearing headphones. Give me a
headphone. I like to wear headphones.
Well, you can wear them. Fine.
Because you know what? I have to actually focus on you.
If you wear the headphones?
Yes, because it helps me hone in on what's the conversation. Because I'm ADD and I have to read lips, it helps me to pay attention. But I can't read your lips because the microphone's covering it.
I can move the microphone.
Uh-huh. You can move the microphone.
Were you diagnosed with ADD?
I have like the most blatant case of undiagnosed ADHD ever.
But
my whole family has ADD. Bigly.
What does that do to your meditation?
It makes me feel like a chipmunk. Remember?
Right.
Yeah,
yes.
The chipmunk equanimity. Are we rolling on this?
Yeah, we're rolling.
Are we actually using this?
Yeah, we're going to use it.
Aren't you supposed to introduce me properly? I know you have copious notes. Where's my bio?
I do that later. I never come into interviews with notes. I'm asking the questions here. Let me keep going. By the way, you made a reference to chipmunk equanimity, which I just explained to people. Mm-hmm. You were a big part of the last book I wrote, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, and you were complaining to the mm-hmm. meditation teacher with whom I wrote the book, Jeff Warren, about how your mind is like a chipmunk, and he wrote a meditation for you called
he did.
Chipmunk.
I have a personal meditation. By the way, you didn't use my alternate title for the book, and I'm still upset about that.
I used it in the book.
I know.
I did say, you want to tell people what it was?
Yes, it was 10% happier, but still a I love you. I do. And I feel like our relationship, when I say it all the time, I'm the sister you never had, nor wanted.
Would right? you say big sister or little sister?
Oh, definitely little sister. Hello, I look so much younger than you, right?
You do. You are actually quite a bit younger than me.
We have a very rare relationship in this. You don't find relationships like ours in this business.
Well, how do you figure?
You're supposed to agree with me.
I'm curious.
Just in my mind? No,
we have a great relationship, but I want to know what you think of it rather than me talking. This is your time.
I just think it's rare to find someone that will laugh with you, laugh at you, yet advocate and champion for you. And here's the thing, like, everyone has an individual agenda in this business. Our ego, this business is driven by our ego, our insecurities. It's rare to find a team player. I think you and I, we just hit it off, even though, as you write in your book, that we are diametrically opposed. Different backgrounds, different ideology. I look a lot younger than you. but we, for whatever reason, we just, I love you. I mean, I know that you've got my back. I know that you will advocate for me. I know that you will make fun of me, if you're not mocking me, and disparaging me, and I can see it in your eyes, the glint in your eyes. And I'm worried that something is wrong.
My wife says the same thing. She says if I'm not teasing her, then right. she thinks I'm in a bad mood.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But see, that's part of your charm. But I just, I you know, I'm so.
I don't
great.
Think my
I'm,
podcast listeners know that about me.
Really?
No, I think they hear me as maybe they, I don't know what they.
What
know
do they
me.
Think you are? Like,
they probably think I'm
spiritual
more
guru,
earnest than I actually.
Oh,
am.
Dan definitely has a devious side. Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. Well, the trick on working with you was that,
there's
and this is true with Sarah Haynes too, who was also on the anchor desk with us at Good Morning America before you both abandoned me, was that I would, off the air, tease both of you relentlessly.
Oh,
but on
totally.
The air, I was always really sweet. And you guys would be so riled up because we'd come out of a commercial break in which I had said a bunch of incendiary things, and then we'd be on the air all of a sudden, and you'd both start picking on me, and then the audience would send you mean tweets.
We took the bait. We have no timing when it comes to the retaliation. And so, yeah, Sarah and I would get excoriated on Twitter and social media. Why are you so mean to Dan? I'm like, if you only knew half of the things he was just saying to us. Do you know that he has his wife programmed as his helper in his phone? No, but I love you. And you know what? Oh, well.
Well, I love you right back, but I want to hear...
That did not sound very... Can you give me a little more enthusiasm? I love you right back. But Dan's uncomfortable with emotion. When I give him a hug, it's very... you've never reciprocated.
I reciprocate.
I think once your arms, like, they reciprocated mildly and they kind of patted me on the back, but you just kind of stand there. You're uncomfortable with emotion.
No, I have a different love language than you do.
What's your love language? Can we say that?
Verbal abuse. I heard my wife saying to my son, my wife was talking to our kid the other day, and I heard her explain to him, you know, if daddy's being silly with you, that means he loves you the most.
Oh, I love it.
So, yes, that's just a different love language.
See, I love that you've embraced the love languages.
Yes,
that we
you were
about.
The first person to use that.
And I think that there's a great book out there besides 10% Happier and your sequel. It's called The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman, and it just breaks it down that we each communicate love in our primary love language. Mine is definitely physical touch. That's how John can love me, my husband, and that's how I give love too. Thus, the uncomfortable, enduring hugs that I love to give you. And also acts of service. I just like to do nice things for people. Mm-hmm. But if he's not communicating in my love languages back to me, I won't feel loved. So your love language is words of affirmation, I would imagine. They're the words of affirmation.
But what I want or what I do?
Well, what fills your tank? Okay, words of affirmation, yeah. Acts of service, gifts, quality time. Did I say physical touch and physical touch?
Those are the five love
languages. Those are the five love
languages.
Which
one fills my tank? Mm-hmm. I think all of them.
Oh my gosh, seriously?
Yeah, I like all those things. But which ones do I communicate in?
Which ones, what makes you feel loved when your wife does X, Y, or Z? What makes you feel more loved than anything else?
What would I say my love language is with my wife? I think the most important thing that goes on between the, from my end, that goes on between the two of us is that I actually need her advice all the time on a million things. And nothing I do goes out into the world without being run through her. And so I want her time and attention to give me advice on the most important projects I've got going.
Quality time?
I guess it's quality time. Like, so she's not working right now. Mm-hmm. She's been taking a year off.
She's working. She's taking care of your child.
Right. Okay. She's not working outside the home. Good point. And so sometimes I have her come to some key meetings with me or for outside projects, not ABC stuff, but book stuff, or she'll travel with me if I'm going to give a speech. And that's really important to me. Mm-hmm. I like having all that time with her. I like to be able to run stuff by her because she's the most important advisor I have. So I guess that would be my answer.
Quality time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Interesting. So anyway, I don't know how we just went down that rabbit hole.
We went down that rabbit hole because you said I was insincere when I said I love you right back. Mm-hmm. I was totally sincere. I guess it's not
really. That's not how I interpreted it, though.
Yeah.
See, no, it's very much open to interpretation, too.
It is, but you're not alone in diagnosing my lack of overt affection.
Okay.
Yes.
It's okay, though.
Anyway, this is about you. So let me do what I was trying to do when I perfunctorily said, is that even a word? I love you right back. I was trying mm-hmm. to refocus the conversation on you. That was really where I was going with it. You said so many things at the beginning of this that I actually kind of want to unpack. But let me just go back all the way to the beginning of the conversation about you and meditation and chipmunk mind. How did you start meditating? Why did you start meditating? When was that? Can you just tell me that story?
Well, I feel like there were several occasions where meditation, where I attempted it. But you were the impetus, okay? And I feel like I had a hard time at the very beginning even attempting it because I didn't really understand it. And it wasn't until you gave me a great analogy, which it's not that you're trying to empty your mind, because for me, it's very, when the moment I close my eyes just dart back and forth and I'm thinking about a million things. It's not so much emptying your mind or clearing your mind. It's just learning how to focus. And when you said it's a bicep for your brain, that was a great
bicep curl. Yeah.
Yes, a bicep. Yeah. You said it was a bicep curl for your brain. That was a great visual, but also Do you remember that analogy, the description that you gave me with the whack-a-mole?
Yes.
Okay, so for me, that's the benefit. That's when I had my aha moment with meditation about what it could do for me. Yes, I'm going to continue to have these distractions, but it's like the whack-a-mole. It's still going to pop up, but I can choose to respond to it in my time, right? So I don't have to be frantic in responding to the whack-a-mole. Those distractions are still going to be there,
yes.
But it's how I choose to react to those distractions.
Yeah. I would say maybe, so there's a difference between how meditation shows up in your mind, how the practice works in your mind when you're doing it, and how it impacts how you are off the cushion in the rest of your life.
Totally.
What I hear you saying there, if I'm hearing you correctly, is it's so funny how ADD you are because you just picked up your phone.
Wanted to pull something because I have something I wanted to read to you, actually.
Okay. That was me picking on you inappropriately, apparently.
but I am. Listen, it's rampant.
It's not something you wouldn't do. Anyway, the whack-a-mole thing is like your life is constantly throwing crazy things at you. You have 3 kids and a more than full-time job and lots of stuff going on. The fact of the matter is all things are going to be popping up at you all the time. What meditation I find helps you do is just kind of not react blindly to all the things that are coming at you.
You're much more focused.
Focused and less emotionally reactive.
Right. And I feel you're focused, but you're intentional, too, about what you react
yes.
to and how you let it affect you.
We recently hired at the 10% Happier Company, we hired a firm of all millennial women to help us come up with new advertising. And they came up with a slogan that I really like, which is life is a mess. You don't have to be. And that, I think, is a really good encapsulation of what the practice does for you.
That's right. Although I still feel like I'm a bit of a hot mess.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's part of the beauty of life.
You don't always have to be a hot mess.
Right, exactly.
Sometimes you won't be.
I'll be honest. You and I have had so many discussions about our faith. Okay, what we believe.
Or my case, lack thereof.
Well, it's still a faith system. And the lack of faith is still, you're believing in something, right?
Well, no. We'll debate that in a second.
You don't have hot or cold water. You have hot in the absence of heat is cold, right? You don't have light and dark. Do you believe in absolutes? Dualism, or is dark just the absence of light? So you just might be the absence. You still have faith in something. We can unpack that later. I think that there's this myth. I am a born again Christian. You know, I love Jesus, right? And we talk about this all the time. And I think there's this, I wouldn't say myth, but maybe a misconception in the Christian community that if you start meditating, you're somehow going to be turned into a Buddhist. That it's somehow part of this religion. So the Bible talks about praying and meditating. I mean, Jesus went into the wilderness to pray and meditate. So I think for me, you know, when I first started hearing about meditation, though, it was in the Eastern religion sense, instead of really looking at what the Bible says about it. And I think that there, as a Christian, I might meditate for different reasons, and I might meditate on different things. Like my mantra is be still, which is a verse from the Bible. And I very much make the practice my own. I wanted to read you this verse from Psalm, and it says, "The heart of the righteous one meditates before answering. And also I will meditate on all your activity and ponder over your dealings." So when the Bible references meditating, it's really like meditating on who God is and his creation.
Hold on. This went by fast. Can you just read the first one again?
The first one is from the Old Testament, which is Proverbs 15:28. It says, "The heart of the righteous one meditates before answering."
Isn't that another way of saying what I just said about whack-a-mole? Or
yes,
what we both just said about whack-a-mole?
Completely.
Which is that life is going to be throwing all these little weasels that are going to be popping out of holes at you, and you can respond wisely to the little weasels.
Exactly.
The righteous heart meditates in those cases, and I'm taking
before
that as
before answering.
Yes, yes.
Right. And then, you know, there are a multitude of references in the Bible, and I just think Christians can benefit so much from meditating. Yes, I'm not going to go to a Buddhist retreat, or that's not what I'm looking to get out of it. And when I'm practicing, I am thinking about, I'm trying to draw nearer to God. I'll do a 3-minute meditation, and that's kind of my go-to. And for 1 minute, I focus on my breath. For the next minute, I go to my happy place, and that's usually Lake Michigan, and I I smell the
air. Where
are
you from?
Where I'm from. I'm from Michigan. So I'll go to the beach and I can feel my hands in the sand and I can hear the seagulls and I can just I can smell. It's the smell of the lake. I can hear the waves. I can smell the suntan oil that I put on. And then the third minute is it would just be some sort of affirmation. You can make that affirmation whatever you want. For me, I'll just say I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. I was, you know, knit together in my mother's womb. You know, I can do all things through Christ. So I'll say affirmations from the Bible. So for me, I've kind of made it my own little Christian meditation practice.
Cool.
And it works for me.
Great. And you say in that first minute when you're on your breath, is that when you're using the mantra about be still?
Yes.
On the in-breath and the out-breath?
Mm-hmm.
And you,
yep.
Do you find that you're able to?
I actually want to get a tattoo that says be still.
That's cool.
On my wrist.
I like that.
Yeah.
You should
do
that.
I'm getting all tatted up.
You have no other tattoos?
I don't.
Okay.
No. You got to start somewhere.
I think it's a good place to start. Do you this every day?
I try to. And it doesn't, I don't sit down for 25 minutes at a time. But
you said 3 minutes.
Yeah,
this is
called a 3-minute cure. I did this experiment with Red Book, and I tried all kinds of crazy.
Red Book magazine.
Yeah, Red Book magazine, and I did.
They had you do an art. This was for an article.
This was for an article. I did an experiment. They wanted me to try all forms of different meditation, including mantra, sound wave, smells. I did the 3-minute cure. The 3-minute cure is one that, like, how can you not make clear 3 minutes out of your day, 180 seconds. You're impressed with my math there, aren't you? So I really like the 3-minute cure. I also will just, if I just need some time to myself, I'll just close my eyes and I'll be still. And that focuses me. I'll do that for 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes.
I think it's great. And I also wouldn't beat yourself up over the fact that, you know, I said, do you do it every day? You said, I try to. One of the things I learned in writing the last book, mm-hmm. is there's this concept that we use now at the company, at the 10% company, is daily-ish, which is like, we just tell people, try to do it most days.
Well, I think that you just have to give yourself some grace.
Yeah.
And we're
yeah.
so hard on ourselves.
Yes.
And we talk ourselves out of it. We're dissuaded because, oh, I can't do it perfectly. Well, it's not about perfection. It's just about trying. Give yourself the same amount of grace you give every other person on the planet. You know, start over. If you didn't do it for 2 days straight, 3 days, a week, whatever, just get back to it. It's okay. Be kind to yourself.
I love that. But I just going back to what you said about being a Christian who meditates and some of the cultural caution that mm-hmm. people have in the evangelical community. I know there have been prominent evangelicals who've gotten up. Reverend Al Mohler's got up and said, you're going to let the devil in if you do this. And the Pope, the former Pope Benedict, called it meditation autoerotic spirituality. So what do you say to your fellow, your co-religionists about this practice?
Well, I say the Bible says pray and meditate. So were we not supposed to obey the Bible? And I think, you know, it's like Halloween. Halloween was a pagan holiday, right? Are we celebrating like the pagans did when we go trick-or-treating? No, you make it your own. And the Jesus, again, went into the wilderness to pray and meditate. And I think if it's in the Bible, I'm gonna go for it. Yes, it could be rooted. There can be some roots in Buddhism. But for me, meditation's rooted in the Bible. How can I argue that? And yes, people are going to turn it into what they want it to be. But you make it your own. And that's what I'm going to go with. I'm going to go with my gut. I'm not, you know, praying to Buddha. I'm not facing east. I'm not doing this for religious Buddhist reasons or any of that or any ideology. I know what I want from it, and that is, you know, to draw closer to God, and I feel like I really can through meditation. But I also want it just for focus and equanimity and, you know, the ability to be intentional and not so scattered with my thoughts.
You have a lot going on. You got 3 kids. I mean, you were running slightly late coming to this interview because your son, your middle child, has pneumonia.
Right.
So you got a lot going on, and plus you work here at ABC. You're traveling all over the place, and this is a pretty this can be a competitive, tough environment. So I'm just wondering, how has this changed you or your the way you relate to all this as a consequence of having this practice?
I think I realized how much I need it. And once I started, I realized how much I needed to do this. And I realized that something was really missing. You know, I have an undiagnosed case of ADD, but if you talk to anybody, they know I have ADD. But this for me, I don't want to take medicine. Then people that do, my family does, whatever. I just don't want to pump myself full of ADD drugs. This really helps me to focus, and it's one of the few things. And so once I started meditating, I realized how much better I felt. It was a spiritual connection to God, physically, mentally. I really noticed a mental difference. There are so many benefits, and I didn't realize how many benefits there were until I started, and then I stopped for a while.
That's a great way to notice the benefits.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So I'm hooked. But I've made it my own.
Yeah.
And as much as you are my spiritual guru, right, and my leader, mm-hmm. What do you say you are to Bianca?
I always ask Bianca, how does it feel to be married to your spiritual leader?
I love it.
I love the eye rolls I get mm-hmm. in response.
I admire you, too. I've seen such a difference in you. Honest to God. I mean, you've endured a lot, too. We all, this can be a really tough business. Just from the physical aspects, the physical grind, the emotional grind, the ego checks. And I've noticed a huge difference in you, not just 10%. I would venture to say 14%. I'm going to go out on a ledge, but you're much more zen. You're happier. The way that you respond, and I don't know for sure if that's because of your meditation practice, but I've seen a huge change in you.
I appreciate that. I think I have a lot of work left to do.
Well, we all do.
Yeah.
But the goal is not perfection, right?
No, I totally agree with that. To the extent that you're comfortable, can you talk about the unique stresses of being in the job that we have?
Yeah.
You can. Okay. Because I don't want to put you on the spot to say things you don't want to say or whatever. But
no.
Okay.
No, I mean, what do you want to know about the stresses?
I want to know about the stresses from your perspective, because I know them from mine.
It's very much a job where there's a huge double standard. I'll just go out and say that.
Men and women.
Oh, yes.
I completely agree. I don't even know what you're going to say, but I think you're right.
Aesthetically, you and I could, you could wear the same suit for 365 days straight.
Nobody's
going to notice.
You and I have talked on the set before about if we were to look at each other's replies on Twitter.
Right.
Some high percentage of yours would either be completely sexually inappropriate or just mean about whatever you were wearing or your hair or makeup.
Sure.
0% of mine would be about how I look.
No. You're the newsman. You're the serious newsman. And I think we're held in many ways. And it's the nature of the business. It's the nature of the culture, unfortunately. But we're held to a different standard. I can say the most profound thing and people will respond, your necklace was crooked. Did you know that? Or what's up with your hair? You know, why does your makeup look funny today? And it's those things that, and I understand that, but that's tough. That's a tough pill to swallow. It's a high stress job. And I say this, everyone that works in the TV business, the news business, we've got a little bit of crazy going on because we thrive off of pressure. And these are high pressure, high stakes situations. You can say one wrong thing and ruin your career.
What about the crazy that makes you want to be in front of millions of people?
Yeah, well, we all have it.
Yes.
Right? I don't know what that crazy is. We thrive. I think for me, I don't work well until the final moment. If you give me 3 months for a project, I'm going to cram it right at the end. That's just when my blood gets boiling, my thoughts start working. I'm a bit of a procrastinator in that sense. Because I know that's when I produce my best work is when I'm stressed, like a grape, like a wine grape. Have you ever been to a vineyard?
I have.
Okay, the grapes are they look like raisins, right? They're distressed, they're withered, but yet the more distressed, the better the concentrate. I kind of feel like a wine grape. I have to be distressed, stressed in order to produce my best fruit.
I see.
In some senses.
I wasn't following that analogy till the end.
Did you follow it at
now
all?
Now I got it. Yeah, now I got you.
I know you abstain from alcohol, so you don't even want that to taint.
Not for religious reasons.
I know. That's another podcast in and of itself. What Dan is not eating these days. But we're not going to go down that road.
So boring. So boring.
That's like 90% more boring. That's the next book, right?
I don't know how I could get more boring.
Good thing you have a really great personality and you're very magnetic.
Sometimes I'm not so sure about that. Anyway, I keep trying to get it back to you.
Oh, sorry. I'm good at deflecting.
The stress of the business isn't just the deadlines and the high wire act of being in public or the criticism that I think is disproportionately directed at females. Especially on an aesthetic level, it's also we're competing with one another.
We're competitors.
You talked about this earlier when you said everybody has an agenda, and you're using that to talk about the sort of unusual nature of our relationship as co-anchors who really had each other's back. What's your view on the sort of competitive nature of the business?
Well, they throw everyone into one ring, and it's different when I've worked in three local markets. So I work for the local affiliate. So if you live in Dayton, Ohio, you work in Cincinnati, or you live in Cincinnati, Ohio, you turn on your local news, or I worked in Chicago, your local news, I worked there. You'll see your local anchors and reporters. So I did local. It's a totally different beast when you come to the network because everybody gets thrown into this pit and the cream will rise to the top. But sometimes to rise to the top, you got to stab one another in the back. It is so competitive. Everyone's going for the same assignments. And that's what makes it difficult. And, you know, at this level, there's so little real estate. There's so in terms of anchoring, reporting, and everybody's fighting for the same fish. And so it's rare when you can hug somebody and know with confidence that they're not going to be stabbing you.
Even if they don't hug you back.
Even
if I don't hug you back, but you know that I'm not stabbing.
Maybe you're not hugging me because you have a knife and you just would feel so awful about stabbing your little sister in the back. No, but it is such, and I say when you get to the network level, it's only 40% talent and it's 60% politics. And it's figuring out how to navigate it. And sometimes the most talented people don't get the best assignments. Sometimes you're excluded because, you know, I can't drop everything. I have three little kids. I remember I was asked to go to the London Olympics, whenever the London Olympics were, I think the 2012. They asked me to go 3 days beforehand and to be gone for 3 weeks. You know, the Olympics, they're like a very last second assignment, right? I mean, it's not on the calendar for 10 years prior to. But I couldn't drop everything. I had two little kids. I had to bring family in for out. I'm like, I would have loved to do it. I went to Brazil for a month to cover the World Cup. But, you know, opportunities like that. And then they look, oh, she's not willing. She can't go. She can't make it happen. So you're almost punished for those situations. And that can be difficult to try to navigate that.
Stay tuned. More of our conversation is on the way after.
This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. I got to tell you, I feel so much better when I talk about my anxiety instead of keeping it bottled up. There's an expression that I first heard from the great researcher and also Zen practitioner Robert Waldinger, never worry alone. Our temptation many times is to keep it bottled up, but the data really show that the people who do the best in life, who live the longest and are the happiest, have strong relationships with people with whom they can talk about whatever's going on in their lives. And for me, therapy is part of that. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/happier today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/happier. As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction.
So you just woke up. Your phone is lighting up with headlines and push notifications and a text from your mom saying, how do I click this? Okay, maybe that's just me. But if you want to get up to speed, check out the new podcast from ABC News. Start here.
Literally, the ground was shaking.
I'm Brad Milkey, and every morning we're going to take you to the stories that matter with fast, fresh insight.
Hello, Robert Mueller. Michael Cohen calling.
All in 20 minutes. Start here. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.
One of the things that I find most interesting about you, and I think has been a source of what could have been what kept us apart, but right. I think it's actually been a big contributor to our friendship, is like you are not the normal, you don't bring into this building the normal biography. I was born in the People's Republic of Massachusetts. Both of my parents are scientists. I was kind of raised to be in the mainstream media, right?
Right.
You are from Michigan. You're raised by evangelical Christians. You went to a college that was, you know, really geared toward Christianity.
It's the Christian Liberal Arts School.
Christian Liberal Arts School. Mm-hmm. What's it called?
Cedarville University.
Cedarville
About
University.
About 3,500 students. I met John there, by the way.
Met your husband there.
College sweethearts. We got married at 24. Something you don't see here on the East Coast.
Right. Right. So what's it like walking into this building every day, given that biography as opposed to mine?
You sometimes feel like you're a fish out of the water, but I've always been, I wouldn't say always, but I like being the devil's advocate. I like bringing a different side to the table. I think that's part of my journalistic instinct. I want to bring, whether that's in a story or just my own personal background, my resume. I don't, you know, I have bring a geographical diversity to the table, ideological diversity to the table. In some senses, I feel a great responsibility to represent marginalized voices that aren't represented. I know what it's like to live in Chicago and to be referenced as a flyover state. I know how hurtful that can be. I can feel the elitism of the East Coast and the West Coast, and nothing else in the middle matters. So I take a personal responsibility to make sure that those views and those voices and opinions are presented and are at the table. So I consider it a great honor. I love it. I feel like I'm thriving. I don't want to be in a room of with a room of like-minded people. I like to be the instigator in some senses. I like to be the odd man out.
Well, I will say, you said before that I'm not super effusive. I will say that your ideological lens, and I don't think that's probably the wrong way to say, because I don't actually think you bring ideology to the office. It's more that you have your own cultural history mm-hmm. that you bring, and you bring a sort of contrarian point of view into the office, has had a profound impact on me. So one of the things that we did for the many years when we were co-anchors on Weekend GMA was every Saturday and Sunday morning, we have a political analyst on to talk about the big news. And in the era of Trump, it's almost always big news. And we would craft those questions together, often in the makeup room, just sort of arguing about what's the most important thing. And you always forced me to think outside of the normal, outside of the box. And then you were, you know, you've turned me on to, well, Ben Shapiro, for example, the conservative podcaster who I now listen to all the time. You know, I have my problems with Ben. I've interviewed him.
He's got some blind spots.
And he's a recent guest on your podcast, which mm-hmm. we will get to eventually. But you've really, really forced me to see my blind spots and my biases. This isn't a question. It's just a long
soliloquy.
A long salute to you you've brought into this office, which I think has been very, very constructive, at least speaking from my narrow.
But don't you think we're better? I think we have an obligation.
Yes.
To think outside of ourselves. Yes. That's why I've learned so much being on the East Coast as well, you know, having lived in the Midwest for 35, 36 years before I moved here. And so it's opened my eyes to different backgrounds, to different ideology. You say ideology. I say ideology. Can you say it either way?
No, I think you're saying it correctly.
Correctly or incorrectly?
Correctly.
Really?
I think so.
For once? Gosh, I'll take
Is that the
I'll
opposite of mansplaining I normally do with you?
No, no. Gosh, this I never win this war. I mean, you are...
I think it's ideology. I think you said it. If that's what you...
You are the king of etymology.
I don't know about that.
No, you really are. Dan's really smart, by the way.
Ish.
You weren't allowed to watch shows growing. Like you could only watch educational shows on TV.
I was allowed very limited TV. Now, of course, I work in the box, which is the ultimate rebellion.
Irony.
And my mom used to, you know, like read it to us out of the dictionary and give us the Latin derivations of words. Yeah, it was super nerdy, pretty nerdy.
So great, though.
My brother's way worse than me.
I have to admit, when I read your books, I have to have a dictionary nearby. But I love that. And but you have this way. You have such a keen sense of writing and conversational way of writing that the words can be lofty, but I kind of still understand what they mean in the context. And I can hear, I can see that twinkle in your eye, and I can tell that some of it's tongue. I know what you're talking about, but I feel like I'm learning so much, not just about the practice of meditation, but I mean, you're dropping some knowledge. I've got my dictionary. What does that word mean?
Everything you just said was super kind, but you are deflecting.
Oh, what are we talking about?
We're talking about you. So I have another question about you, which is that you did a really, I think, brave thing recently in a professional context.
I killed my career.
You didn't kill your career. But you took, I want you to tell the story. But I want to ask, before you tell the story, one question that hopefully will just get woven into the answer, which is, did your meditation practice... The calm equanimity, any of that little dose of calm and equanimity that was injected into your life through meditation in any way contribute to this big decision that you're going to talk about?
I think it did because it made me realize how out of balance my life was. And I may not have felt that otherwise. But I remember you and I, so this summer I decided to walk away from Weekend GMA, walk away from The View into this ambiguous base of my career. I'd been working weekends for the better part of 17 years, virtually my entire marriage, three little kids. My health started to suffer. But when I broached it initially the summer of 2017, so a year prior, I remember I had talked to you about it. And you literally, I remember you came back and you said, I thought you were crazy. And I think that's what most people thought. Why would you walk away from two dream jobs into this space of the unknown? You understood why I was doing it, for I needed some work-life balance, right? But still, we get so sucked into our own ego and we inflate who we are in our own minds and the impact that we're having on other people. And we don't realize that, like, I was more focused on the spotlight instead of my own sanity. Everybody was getting my leftovers, my husband, my kids, and I realized that my job had become a bit of an addiction. It had become my narcotic of choice. Honestly, I was addicted to the thrill of you know, being on TV. Addicted to my ego, I guess you could say. And I knew that if I walked away, people would think I'm crazy. Oh, she was forced out. And I was worried what people were thinking would think about me if I stepped down. And then, so this the summer of 2017, I had spoken with you. I had spoken with another executive and who had told me flat out, you're crazy if you walk away. And it would be hard for you to climb up the ladder here, you know, to be promoted if you walked away. We're not going to promote somebody that's not an anchor. So I let that fear really paralyze me. And I dug deeper. I'm like, okay, I'll just prove to them how important I am here. I'm going to stay put. And then I went through a really tough season. And it started with a miscarriage. The day before I interviewed Sean Spicer, I had this big interview with Sean Spicer. I was getting an exclusive with him. First time he had spoken since his controversial Emmy appearance. Day before I found out, I went to the doctor. John and I went to go see the baby. No heartbeat. So I'm conducting the interview thinking the child inside of me is probably dead, which is a tough feeling, you know, when you're conducting, talk about triumph and tragedy in one moment.
Well, I just kind of stop you for a second. We've been through miscarriage too, but my family, but obviously I'm not the one carrying it, so I can't pretend to understand the half of how horrible that must feel. But for those of those in the audience who haven't seen the Sean Spicer interview, you were incredibly good in that interview. And so it's amazing to me because I didn't know the timing. I'd forgotten the timing. Mm-hmm. But I do remember the interview, and you were really spot on in that interview. It's so incredible to me that you were carrying a lot of emotional distress into it.
Right.
Because it didn't show.
I kind of, and the thing is, I run to work. I've noticed, and that's when that was one of my coping mechanisms when I had to go back to the doctor the following week to confirm that the baby wasn't viable. I had to take a pill. A couple of days later, I developed an infection, had to have an emergency procedure on a Friday, got home at 11:30 that night, and the next day, you were gone that weekend, I went right back to work. I just dug deeper. That's how I cope. I go back to work. I don't want to think about it. So I get up 4 hours later after I've had an emergency DNC. Mm. So that was part one. A month later, I'm doing a live shot in front in Wall Street. And some, can I say that?
Ryan okay. is saying no, but right. they'll bleep it.
So a month later, I'm on Wall Street doing a live shot for Good Morning America about the bull run, which the irony of me doing a story on the stock market. Okay. Anyway, I was roughly 10 to 20 seconds from going live, and these two hoodlums threw something at my head. I didn't know what it was right away. They threw an apple at my head, but they threw it so hard that the apple exploded on my head. And luckily it wasn't on camera. I know I'd be dubbed Apple Girl forever, but I got a concussion from it. The police found surveillance video. They said it was two kids. They never found them, by the way. They were probably on their way to school. They said that they threw it 60 miles an hour. So it hit the side of, like, right behind my ear bone. If my face had been turned just a couple of, like, centimeters to the right, it would have shattered the right side of my face. So I had a concussion. I was forced to sit out for 3 weeks. The day, and I'm talking 5 minutes after I get an email from work clearing me to go back to work, I get into a car crash. Not my fault. Head-on collision. I've just dropped John off at the train station where we live, driving my minivan. Minivan's totaled. I can't go back to work right away. Then, a couple of months later, I get influenza, which subsequently turns into pneumonia. That's 7 months of my life. Okay? I don't know if God could have, like, screamed any louder that I needed to slow down. And I needed to take this step of faith and walk into the unknown and take care of myself. And so it was in that moment, literally I felt like God had to hit me over the head with that apple. But he needed to get my attention. I was so addicted to work, and I was so addicted to the high of my job. And, you know, when I first broke the news to the bosses, you know, they were supportive. They didn't want me to step away. I mean, there's no one that can deny that we had great chemistry, the whole team. It's hard to find rapport like that. But they honored my decision. It was really tough, but I felt like that's what I was supposed to do.
I think it was incredibly brave. I think it was, I mean, I was selfishly not happy about it because I didn't want you to go.
But initially, you thought I was a little cuckoo. You're like, why would you walk away from this? And that's what most people thought. And that's what I bought into. I bought into that fear, and I thought, everybody's right. I'm totally crazy to walk away.
Yeah, but
from
a big
this.
Part of my resistance was just selfishness because I knew it was going to be bad for me. I thought it was going to be bad for me.
Isn't meditation supposed to help you with your selfishness?
Oh, you know, 10% buys me a lot of room to continue to be an idiot. That was my problem with it. But once you explained, hey, look, I got to work on my marriage, you know, not that you guys were having problems, but just that.
No, I needed to invest in my marriage.
And your kids.
Yeah, I did.
And so once you said it that way, it made a lot of sense. And actually, it's provoked a lot of really healthy thinking for me and dialogue with my wife about work-life balance. And so it's been I talked about how you had an ongoing impact on my thinking about tribalism, for example, and bias and the media, big impact. But this was another decision you made that really helped me think about my own life.
Yeah.
So I think it was a really brave move. How are things going?
They're going great, but it's one of the toughest parts about it. It's not like I was leaving two dream jobs for this other cushy gig. I literally, it's that quote from Martin Luther King, faith is taking that step when you can't see the rest of the staircase. I literally felt like I couldn't even see the step I was on.
So you basically, just to fill people in, you decided to become a correspondent here instead of you were a co-host of The View, you were the co-host of Weekend Good Morning America, and now you have neither of those titles.
I had anchor titles.
Which is a big deal in our industry, and now you are a correspondent for ABC News, and you travel and do all sorts of stories, but it's a much less well-defined role.
Oh, completely. It's not defined. And, you know, I think I was a little too prideful in the sense that, and haughty, I thought that, oh, I'm not defined by what I do. I'm defined by who I am. I'm a wife. I'm a mom. I'm a child of God, you know. And so, but the moment I walked away from what I did, I didn't know who I was anymore. And there was a lot of guilt involved in that. Why isn't being a mom enough? Why isn't being a wife enough? Why isn't, you know, being a child of God enough? And there was a tremendous amount of guilt, not just that those weren't enough, but the fact that I had totally lost my identity in what I did.
It's not that long ago, so you
I'm still working through all of this, but I'm better every day. But that was a huge wake-up call. I mean, if you asked yourself, if I walked away from what I do, would I still know who I am? I thought I would always know the answer. I didn't realize that this quote-unquote vocational calling that I had completely consumed me to the point that I didn't know who I was outside of it anymore.
And I think that's part of why you get that response from the bosses and from me, your friend, when you propose this idea is because you're triggering, I can only speak for myself, fear in me. You know, could I do what she's doing? You know, could I? Even after all this meditation, could I walk away? I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it really forced me to think about it in ways that I'm still wrestling with today.
Yeah, and thank you for that. It's been tough, though, because I've been very introspective and just realizing that, again, I had become addicted to my job and I didn't realize it.
But one of the things you've done, this is, gets us to ostensibly why you're here, which of course I'm going to be bringing up at the last minute here, but which is your fault because you're too interesting on all these other subjects, is one of the things you did that I think I have a lot of respect for and I think is going to be incredibly successful is – you thought really long and hard and strategically about, you know, how can I mold this job into – how can I channel my profound interests into this new sort of undefined role?
Sure.
So you started a podcast
where
you talk to people about faith.
Right.
So can you just talk about that for a second rather than having me talk about it?
When I broached this subject of stepping away with the bosses, they said, well, what do you want to do? I said, I want to work on big stories, the people that are the center of them. So, you know, substantial stories, consequential interviews. And I said, and I want to launch a faith podcast. And I actually have you to thank, of all people, my whatever you are, atheist, agnostic friend. You and I were talking months ago, and I was like, I just don't know what my lane is. Is it parenthood? And you're like, it's faith, you dummy. You didn't probably say dummy, but for me, I don't see myself, it's not a hobby, it's not a habit, it's who I am, and it's, I can't see myself without it. I don't see myself separate from faith. So I didn't even think about it. But for you, you are able to identify, this is your lane, this is who you are. And so you're the one that encouraged me to do the faith podcast.
I did? I don't even remember that.
Take some credit, yes.
Okay, well,
you helped me.
Good idea.
We talked about what my lane could be, and I still remember, you're like, it's faith. You should do a podcast on faith.
Well, I mean, and I also think you come at it from such a unique perspective because you have a foot in both worlds.
Right.
You have a foot in the secular Upper West Side mainstream media world, and you have a foot in mission.
I'm good at straddling, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Two separate worlds.
You're a gymnast.
Gymnast. No, I feel like there's such a hole in the market because we want to talk to newsmakers and influencers about their latest project, about, you know, that game-winning touchdown, about something salacious they said in the news, but we don't talk to them about their faith. If they mention, you know, Jesus or Allah or Buddha, what have you, we're going to believe. We don't want that. You know, that's not what this interview is about. And so I just sense the fact that, yes, I am a Jesus follower. I can't imagine my life without my faith. It has been so important to me and guided me and carried me when my marriage was on the rocks, when I've had multiple miscarriages, didn't think we could even have babies. through moves cross country, several. It has sustained me so much, and I can't imagine my life without it. It is my glue and my foundation and my rock. And I know there's other people that feel the exact same way, regardless of whether they're Christian, they're Jewish, they're Muslim, they're atheist. And I want to give people an opportunity to talk about what they believe, why they believe it, and how it's navigated their life through triumph and tragedy. I just think there's a hole for it. You can go to the 700 Club. You can go to Rabbi Shmuley, you know, which Roseanne Barr did. But you can't, there's no mainstream outlet that's giving people that platform to talk about it. And so that's what I want to do. And I just sat down with Sam Harris, who is totally out of my league, by the way. This guy's a philosopher and you're good friends with him. He's been on your podcast, right?
He has, and I've been on his. Yeah. I think I've been on his. Maybe I have. I don't know. Anyway, Sam is a good friend of mine. So he was, but let's say you've had many guests, some of them super famous, like country music stars.
Luke Bryan, Hillary Scott, Kellyanne Conway, Tim Tebow. I'm having Reza Aslan, who grew up Shia, converted to Christianity, then converted back to Islam. So I also want to encourage dialogue with people that we disagree with. I don't have anything in common with Sam, but I want to hear where he's coming from. I don't want to debate. Listen, that's not a debate anybody wants to see me and Sam Harris. I would get my butt kicked, okay? But I want to establish that we can have respectful conversation. I mean, if you think about some of the more profound conversations you've had, it's with people, you and I, people yes. that you don't see eye to eye with.
Yes.
So let's just learn to just pull up a chair, find some common ground. Let's listen. Let's respect one another. I want to know more about other religions. That doesn't mean that I'm questioning my faith, but I do think you need to question your faith. You need to know what you believe and why you believe it. You need to, you know, the Bible says, be able to explain the hope that is within you. And this is challenging me. I hope it challenges other people. I don't want to just sit down. You know, Jesus sat next to sinners and people that he didn't see eye to eye with. I want to be able to do that. I want to sit down with people from all different walks and ask them what they believe and why they believe and inspire people.
And I think that impulse is incredibly important right now in this country where, you know, one of the big benefits of my friendship with you is that I feel like we're doing something that the rest of the country really needs to do, which is we're having respectful, I mean, sometimes it's more locker room, well, not so respectful, but
not in the Access Hollywood locker room sense.
Right, that's right. But we, you know, we have respectful conversations, even though we probably use a lot of profanity, about profound disagreements. And that is what America is missing right now.
People won't even listen to you.
No, well, we're not talking to each other.
I know.
Because we have our own silo. If you're a Fox News viewer, you're not listening to MSNBC. If you're an MSNBC viewer, you're not listening. I'm not trying to pick on those two outlets, but we have our own tailored social media feeds. We can't even agree on basic facts. And so I give the credit to you in terms of teaching me how to do this because you're the one who's had to walk into an environment where most people probably don't share your cultural.
Am I your life guru now? A little bit.
I would say you've been very useful in my life.
Useful. Can you just say I've been inspirational and that you aspire to be like me?
Put it in the teleprompter. Maybe I'll read it off.
I love it. I've missed you. No, but I encourage people to tune in and to support it and to subscribe. Journeys of Faith. We have Marla Maples and coming up. We have Reza Aslan, who's Muslim. We did Ben Shapiro, Robin Roberts. We have Sherry Shepherd, Melissa Joan Hart. And then season two, you know, I'm open to your suggestions. So
before we go, let's have the debate you started at the beginning I said tabling. You said something about atheism is a faith system or something like that. Can you just go back?
Are we really going to end on this
note? I don't like bringing something up and then telling people we're going to table it and then not bringing it back.
Okay,
so that's
my
job.
I talked to Sam Harris, who from his vantage point, he does not believe that it is a faith system.
I don't either. But I wouldn't call myself an atheist. And I think he has some problems with that word, too.
Right. And we tried to differentiate between atheism and agnosticism. And I think
I think there's a key difference there.
Yes.
I mean, even in the roots of the word, right? You know the roots of the word. Atheism is without God. Agnostic is without knowledge. So I don't know if there's a God. Mm-hmm. I don't know. How do I know? So I can't tell. I wouldn't sit here and say everything you believe is patently untrue. I just don't know.
Right.
What
you classify yourself to be?
I would say I'm a respectful agnostic as it pertains to organized religion. I would also call myself a Buddhist, but not in the religious sense, in that mm-hmm. I think of Buddhism as something you do, not as something you believe in. So I meditate. I find the sort of philosophical and ethical explorations, philosophical stuff in Buddhism to be really interesting and actionable.
Sure.
But I can't tell you that karma is real or that reincarnation, I've seen no evidence for that. But what I like about the Buddha was he was like, take it or leave it. Do the meditation, take it or leave it.
Sure.
And by the way, he had no creation myth about the universe. He had no, he was just a dude who died. He didn't, claim to be a god or a prophet or anything like that. But to the extent that he made metaphysical claims, I maintain an agnosticism.
Right. I just enjoyed sitting down with Sam. I don't agree with him. You know, I understand where he's coming from, though. I understand the problems that he has. So I just think there you can't prove everything in a scientific lab. And I think that so many philosophers, scientists, neuroscientists, they want to prove everything in a lab. If I asked you to prove your love for Bianca, you could scientifically prove it, but you'd also have to factor in circumstantial evidence, direct evidence, just like you do in a courtroom. And so I think that's where I have a problem with people saying science can't prove. Science can prove. I mean, anthropologists, theologians, scholars, psychologists, psychiatrists can prove that Jesus existed. It's just you have a problem with whether or not he rose from the dead.
Right? Or was the Son of God. I think
or
both
was the
ends
Son
of
God. The divinity as well. Yes. But I think, there's an aspect also of faith. But I think, again, you got to dig into it. You can't just say, I was raised this way. You need to know why you believe it. It can't just be the faith of your parents.
Here's a suggestion for season two, perhaps. I issue this gingerly, but somebody.
Donald Trump?
If you can get him, definitely, definitely. Francis Collins, okay. who is he? He's the head of the NIH, National Institutes of Health, I think.
Okay.
Hopefully I'm not wrong about that. Anyway, he's a devout Christian.
Nice.
And I sat and interviewed him once, and I pressed him a lot of the kind of things you're talking about here. And his answer was ultimately just, I think he's saying what I think you're saying, which is ultimately just does come down to a leap. Mm-hmm. At the end of it.
At the end of it, there is a bit of a leap of faith. And I come back to my brother-in-law was an atheist for 30 plus years. He's a physician. And he just talks about his moment where he realized, we are such intricate beings. We couldn't have just been random. That was an aha moment for him. And I say, I have all these questions and there's so certain things you can't answer. And he's like, I just realized if I could explain every single thing about God, he would be too small. And I think at some point, the Bible even says that now we see through a glass dimly, then we're going to see face to face. To God, a day is 1,000 years and 1,000 years is as a day. We're trying to, as mere mortals, figure out an infinite, immortal being. And if I could do that, God would be way too small. So there is definitely a sense of faith. I do think you have to have the knowledge. You need to dig in. You need to be able to answer profoundly, what do you believe and why do you believe it? It cannot be the faith because it's the faith of your fathers. You need to it needs to be real and personal for you. And that's one thing I hope to encourage people with the podcast. It has totally challenged me. So that's what I want to do. Did you subscribe yet? Give me your if you have not subscribed to my podcast.
I don't know.
I'm going to walk out of this studio right now. Where's your phone?
It's in my pocket.
Let me I'll see. Get you,
let me just say
no,
something.
No. Let me see your phone. Hand it over, Dan Harris.
You're not going to be able to unlock it.
Unlock it right now.
By the way, look how broken it is.
Okay, just subscribe. Okay. If you're not subscribed, I'm going to be so mad at you. So hurt.
I think I subscribed.
No, you didn't.
Somehow I overlooked it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, mm-hmm. You did. You have to just listen and give me a little feedback. All right.
Just subscribed. I'm embarrassed that I haven't subscribed, actually.
It's okay. Because that's a key that people need to know. It is important to subscribe because you have a lot of listeners that might download, but they have not subscribed. Subscribing is so important, right?
Yes, it is.
That's how they know. That is their metric of success
is
subscriptions.
It's it's also listens per episode. It's a big deal.
LPs.
Is that what they're called?
I don't know.
I just made that up.
I said that with confidence.
Downloads?
Though, didn't I?
I don't
LPEs.
Know.
LPEs.
Can I say something in closing? Am I allowed to do that?
Are we going to say the Lord's Prayer? The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift you up with, look upon you with favor and give you his peace. I pray that over my kids every night.
That's the first time that's been done on this podcast, but
really?
Respect.
There you go. I was just joking, by the way, when I said that, but you let me go with it, so why not?
What I was going to say is I do love you, and I really hope that this podcast is a massive success.
If I could have 10% of the success of your podcast, I would be happier.
How about I?
Did you see what I just did?
That was so clever. It was awesome. How about my podcast ultimately is 10% as successful as yours? That would be the right order in the universe, I think.
Okay.
Let's go for that.
Let's push for that.
Thank you for coming on.
Anytime. This has been pleasure of the day.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. So long.
Okay, that does it for another edition of the 10% Happier Podcast. If you liked it, please take a minute to subscribe, rate us. Also, if you want to suggest topics you think we should cover or guests that we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. Importantly, I want to thank the people who produce this podcast, Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, and the rest of the folks here at ABC who helped make this thing possible. We have tons of other podcasts. You can check them out at abcnewspodcasts.com. I'll talk to you next Wednesday. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fu, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the new Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now, I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, The Competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully, no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.